An estimated 1 in 2 people will experience degrading environmental conditions this century and will be faced with the difficult question of whether to leave their homes. Will you be among those who migrate in response to climate change? And if so, where will you go?
Abram Lustgarten is an investigative reporter, author, and filmmaker whose work focuses on human adaptation to climate change. His 2010 frontline documentary, The Spill, which investigated BP's company culture, was nominated for an Emmy. His 2015 long-form series, Killing the Colorado, about the draining of the Colorado River, was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. Lustgarten is a senior reporter at ProPublica and contributes to publications like the New York Times Magazine and The Atlantic. His research on climate migration influenced President Biden's creation of a climate migration study group. This is also the topic of his newly published book, On the Move, in which he explores how climate change is uprooting American lives.
Abram Lustgarten, welcome to One Planet Podcast and the Creative Process.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
So excited to speak with you about your book, On the Move, which focuses on future climate migration within the United States and such a thought-provoking response to the ecological challenges of our time, told through the lens of personal stories highlighting the possibility of people leading more nomadic lifestyles, where home is where the changing climate has the least effect, as On the Move prompts us to reassess and reevaluate our relationship with the changing natural world and the landscapes we call home. Before we dive into the conversation, I believe you've selected a passage to share with our listeners.
Yeah, thank you. This is a passage about a woman named Colette Pichon Battle, who's one of the people that I write about, who is trying to deal with how climate change changes where she lives. And after Hurricane Katrina struck New Orleans in 2005, she moves home to the Louisiana coast, and she moves home to try to protect her community and help it rebuild and to basically resist the tides of potential climate migration. And so this is just a little bit about Colette and her experience there. As tens of thousands of people continued to leave the wreckage of Louisiana in the weeks and months following the storm, and Mary remained a refugee, that's her mother, Colette moved back home. 15 generations on the bayou, a legacy in jeopardy, exerted a gravitational pull she could not resist. The devastation spoke to her. The rebuilding beckoned. She thought about the survivors. There are these trees here, she says, describing the deeply rooted, majestic oaks that dot the landscape of southern Louisiana and the Mississippi coast. The tidal surge snapped the pines like pixie sticks. The briny ocean water turned grasses brown and dead, killing animals and fish both, along with flowers and shrubs. Not everything made it, she said, but these trees, these oaks, they made it, and they stood. Colette knew that her home might never be rebuilt. She knew her mother might never come back, but she tells the story, grasping for an explanation for why she herself returned, trying to find words that could describe the role she felt suddenly compelled to fulfill. And I feel more like that, right? She says, comparing herself to the aged oaks. I feel like that. I'm watching other trees go down. I'm watching changes, but I've got the roots that are strong enough to hold. And so Colette became the resistance, pushing back against all the forces arrayed against her, the storm after the storm. She thought at the time she'd join a great healing, the rebuilding that would bring her mother home and the restoration of all the ties that gave life their meaning. She would bring the whole bayou home. She began to talk about the risks in terms that the bayou community around her could not recognize. She warned that if they failed to rebuild, to be resilient, the only option would be to migrate away from Louisiana's southern coast. That while the recovery from the storm looked bleak, the alternative could be far worse. People thought we were crazy, she says, but that's how it begins.
Great beginning and an opening to such a complicated issue. Of course, many people consider their landscape as cultural symbols and often associate their identity with the land and its natural resources. And so it's comforting to know that, you know, this is home, this is where I belong. But of course, in the future, as you point out, climate change and internal migration within the United States may force many people to leave their regions in search of more habitable locations. And this will be a new experience for Americans in the second half of the 21st century. For the time being, you've decided to stay in the Bay Area, despite the wildfires, because it's where your family is. It's your story. You know, home is where we have our roots. And so it's so difficult, even if we have that option of moving, which not everyone has. And many of us, I think, always think about climate change as a global issue or a national issue, or it's how do we move the policymakers to make changes. But it's so hard to even make those moves in our own life and decide what we keep and what we let go of in order to create a sustainable future for our families.
Yeah. You know, you point out that we think of climate change, I think, often as a global and a sort of a policy-oriented issue. And I wanted to both localize it, but also individualize it. You know, this entire project about climate migration, before I even wrote the book, arose from this question of how are people going to begin to experience the changes on the planet when I think we focus so much on the physical change, you know, on what the science says about the change. And the extension of that has been the great lesson of this process for me, realizing that moving in response to climate change, just like moving in response to other things, is a highly personal decision, that there is no prescriptive answer. I didn't write a book trying to tell you what you should do or how soon you'll have to do it or anything like that, but more coming from a place of empathy, realizing that it's a complicated process and it's a personal decision that can be informed by a better understanding of the changes in the environment around us and possibly supported by knowing that other people around you, around your community, are also experiencing those changes and grappling with a similar decision.
And previous to this, you've written about climate migrations, Chinese to Russia, Syrians into Europe, and Central American migrants, which you also touch on in this book. So why did you choose to turn your focus towards America on what seems like a more personal story than your previous books?
Yeah, because I had to start somewhere. You know, I think all of those stories are important and all of them should be told. And the United States experience of climate change is going to be difficult and challenging, but it's relative to other parts of the world that will have it much worse off. You know, and so we have our wealth and our privilege in this country, and they kind of try to keep that in the background. But I was also just fascinated with the fact that we, just like everybody else in the world in the United States, will face these changes and face decisions that result from them just the same. They're just, maybe orders of degree different. So I was in the course of my own reporting. You mentioned a lot of reporting in Central and South America. And I had come back from one of those trips, and I live in California, and we were in the midst of our own really scary wildfire season. We had fires close to where I live, and the entire state was very smoky. It was hard to breathe, hard to go outside. It was really kind of an oppressive couple of months. And that really drew my attention to the inescapability of these issues for us at home too, right? I would just come back from San Salvador, a challenged part of the world, and arrived at San Francisco International Airport, right? It's like the bastion of modern development and advancement. And here I faced my own version of equally threatening pressures. And that personal experience drove me to this particular story.
Indeed, there are no borders when it comes to climate disruption. So far, you've decided to stay in the Bay Area because, of course, as you say, it's so difficult to bring up roots. But it also felt to me like maybe in your reporting, you could be testing out, oh, this is a haven city. Down the line, would that be a place, that a community there I could move with my family that are really future ready and can deal with the influx?
When I began to write this book, I thought that by the time I finished it, I would have moved somewhere and it would provide a great narrative arc for the text. And I would finish the book describing my wonderful experience on my new farm in Vermont or something like that. Obviously, that hasn't happened for me yet. What has happened is a really complex process, almost more of a psychological process. And I hear it reflected in others that I've talked to and interviewed for the book as well, where I have come to understand the specific risks and perils that, you know, that I face living in California, for example, better than I did before. So I can see them clear-eyed. But I've also had a lot of time to reflect on the reasons why I chose to live where I live in the first place and what I appreciate about it. And so that gives me kind of a pros and a cons column that already nuances the decision. And, you know, in addition to that, I've just come to accept the unsettledness of this era that we're moving into. And I think that that's really how I see the future, is that we're living in an era of disruption, some degree of chaos and incontinuity. And it might be a very practical and pragmatic decision for me or for many, many others to change where they live. That may still happen. But in the background is still going to be the uncertainty about whether that's the right choice. And for me, in this particular moment, that means that I've kind of settled on the uncertainty of living here too. So I haven't moved. I love where I live. I remain for the moment, but I accept that that may change. That's not a permanent decision. And there's others that I talk to and that I write about in the book who also muse about the possibility of a more nomadic future, that maybe home isn't a permanent place with deep roots, but is a transient place with shallow roots, or two places that you alternate between, or things like that. And I think that in addition to a lot of other dramatic changes that the book is about, a change in our sense of home and our sense of place is a part of this story.
That's the other part, that as well as being able to financially be ready to move and create another home, there's the psychological preparedness as well that's an essential part of being future ready.
Yeah, I think we're all being pushed hard to see how flexible we can be in our thinking, in our lives, and maybe in our finances if we have that opportunity in every possible way. And that's only going to become a greater and greater need going forward.
Yes, many of us are designed to stay in the place we might be in a more temperate zone, so we're not yet affected, though I understand, and this seems hard to fathom, that maybe 1 in 3 of us will have to become climate migrants within the century. And I guess it's this gamble whether we stay in high-risk areas. Like, we do have the technology to mitigate climate change. I mean, if fingers crossed, if we can stay beneath 1.5 degrees of change, which they say we're going to reach this century, 2 degrees of change, if the seawalls will hold up. You know, what are your reflections on how we can make our cities future ready for those who decide to stay?
Yeah, so let me back up a little bit on that. A lot of my reporting is based on a body of research that looks at the ideal habitat that humans have lived in on the planet for about 6,000 years. And that ideal zone is shifting. And as it's shifting, it's leaving large parts of the world and its population outside of that ideal zone. And so that's where we can say that 1 in 3 or 1 in 2 people on the planet, and a roughly 1 in 2 people in the United States as well, will find themselves in degrading environmental conditions that in the past have led to migration. So we really don't know how many of those people will move. But if we talk about 2 to 6 billion people facing that difficult decision, then we can assume there will be a very large era of mass movement of people to some degree. And the trend then globally, but also in the United States, is that many of those people will move to cities, that we will see an increasing urbanization, which is demographically what we've already seen for many decades now. And so that would intensify. And I think a lot of the conversation around climate migration is about where people will go. And that is a really important part of the conversation. But as you're alluding to, also half of the conversation is about where people will leave from and what happens to those communities. And I think adapting to these changes requires both. And when you drill down and get really into the, you know, the nuts and bolts of it, a lot of the conversation is about urban planning and sustainability planning and what that means for cities. And it means different things, whether you're on the growing or the sort of shrinking, contracting end of the spectrum. But when I look at prospective change for urban areas in the United States, it's clear that defending them physically, I'm thinking primarily of like coastal cities and sea level rise, the most, you know, immediate physical threat. Building seawalls to defend these cities is incredibly expensive. It's happening and it will happen for the most valuable of our cities. And I hate that it all gets framed economically, but it does. You know, so New York will ultimately build a seawall that it estimates now will cost somewhere in the order of $120 billion. And the fact is that many cities in the United States will not be able to afford that, especially smaller ones and especially southern ones. And so a part of planning for this needs to include thinking about managed retreat from highly vulnerable areas, perhaps about making communities smaller or planning to keep them smaller. You know, one real risk is that as some communities see an outflow of people, even if it's only a partial outflow or not an abandonment of a place, but it undermines the tax base of that community that supports schools. It undermines the real estate market and the value of property. And it can lead to a spiral of economic decline that can be really dangerous for the people who remain, and that could really hollow out a community. And that's a enormous challenge to deal with. But one way to deal with it is to try to keep the resources and infrastructure in a community proportional to the population that's utilizing it, and to maintain some energy and prosperity and vitality by not having this kind of mismatch of hollowed out buildings and empty spaces that are unoccupied because maybe the land base for the map of a city is larger than it needs to be with a smaller population. So I think a lot of places in the United States need to plan to get smaller, which is really the antithesis of, you know, of the American philosophy of growth and economic growth. And that's going to be a real challenge. And in destination cities that can expect to grow, climate migration will underscore the need for a lot of very traditional kinds of investments, but make them more urgent and probably more expensive, and need for fair and affordable housing and great transportation and easy access to food, to grocery stores. A lot of less affluent parts of American cities have food deserts and don't have easy access to good food, jobs, schools, affordable energy. All the kind of basic things we've always needed and are a little behind on will need to be improved and even faster.
Yeah, it's strange because a lot of those wealthier places who are building up that infrastructure are also so vulnerable. And then how could, I mean, can it be transported to these areas that will be the safe havens in the future?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think people have only barely begun to think about that question. And when I think about it, I think that there's a great amount of sort of trauma that will be inevitably experienced by people who are moving. And one question is, will people move from a community as a diaspora and just sort of go wherever they go and end up scattered about the country? And for a receiving community, that might mean you see growth statistically, but it's hard to pinpoint what type of growth that is, what community is coming into your community and mixing with you. Or is there some more organized form? And some of the urban planners that I spoke with in my reporting muse about the possibility of moving whole communities or of having sister communities where, say, a small town in coastal Georgia might at least decide that a small town in Michigan is where some people are going to move. And if you want to keep your community intact, you could move together, or you could move to a place where you know that your neighbors have also moved or something like that. And that's the kind of new idea that is being batted around that can help keep communities coherent.
And in terms of these abandoned or somewhat, you say, reducing community sizes for those areas of the country that become unlivable, what can be done there? How can the land be used without it becoming a wasteland?
Yeah, there is going to be painful results of this transition that I think are kind of unavoidable. I mean, I try to have this conversation in the least apocalyptic kind of way, and there's a lot of opportunity and dynamic change to talk about. But there's also the fact that much of this change is going to be painful and is going to be unavoidable. And I think losing the use of land in certain parts of the country is an inevitable part of that process, and mainly because water is increasingly scarce, especially in the American Southwest. And there's a distinction between industrial agriculture that needs a kind of infrastructure and availability of water and our ability to grow our own gardens and our own backyard on a smaller scale. And that might remain a lot more possible. But either way, it's going to be an ongoing challenge in places like Arizona, New Mexico, or even Southern California. And keeping that land active and viable outside of cities, you know, for agriculture or for anything else, is going to require a lot of really difficult and complex decisions about how the limited water resources that are available are shared. There is a great amount of water in the Colorado River, for example, but not as much as the country uses. And so right now we're in a really difficult political process of basically reapportioning, you know, that water and deciding how it should be allocated. And should more of it go to cities? Can it be saved if it doesn't go to farms? And you can break down then how those farms use that water. Should they grow essential crops? Should they grow vegetables? Should they grow extremely water-intensive crops like alfalfa, which get exported out of the country, or go to feed beef and cows so we can export the meat and things like that, which I think are lower value uses. And all that's a long way of saying there's a lot of like incremental decisions that can extend the availability of resources like water for a long time into the future. And so I think if carefully managed and some painful compromises are agreed upon, lands in really hard hit parts of the United States can remain viable and usable for a long time. But on the balance, if you go to Arizona now and there's hundreds of thousands of acres of cotton being grown, I think that that's going to change. And, you know, I think in 2 decades, you'll go to those same places and you'll see the lack of agriculture. I wouldn't call it wasteland because it's natural land and it'll go back to the way it always was for millennia before that, but it'll be a lot less usable to people.
Where you are now near Silicon Valley, of course, that uses a lot of water as well for cooling data centers, etc. So water management is hugely important. I realize that, of course, that America grows a lot of wheat, but I didn't realize how much of that is being exported to other countries. So it's not just about personal, that'll affect people around the world.
Yeah, wheat and corn, but wheat especially is an enormous export for the United States. And I don't know the percentage, but a very large percentage of the wheat that's grown is exported and not used domestically. And we are, depending on the year, first or the second largest exporter of wheat around the world. Russia alternates with us depending on what they produce in a given year. And a very large swath of the planet depends on our wheat exports for their staple food supplies. And those exports, some of them are purchased and they go to customers across Africa, for example, in North Africa. But a lot of it comes in the form of aid as well. You know, U.S. foreign aid comes in often in the form of food aid. And so a disruption to U.S. wheat production would have enormous ripple effects around the world geopolitically. And there's a study out of Columbia University that measured this and looked at these ripple effects. But what it basically found is that a sharp decrease in American wheat production would lead to food shortages in dozens of countries, lives around the middle part of the planet, but also to a real decrease in U.S. influence and leverage geopolitically, because so much of our diplomacy is intertwined with the aid that we give, which often comes in the form of food supplies.
Of course, we've been mainly talking about internal migration within the United States and not an influx of climate migrants, which might be coming into the United States.
Yeah, you know, it's for part of my reporting, and this didn't play heavily in the book, but we tried to model with a number of demographers here at Columbia University and the City University in New York, what happens under different climate scenarios in terms of migration. And it's really interesting and kind of counterintuitive, but what the models suggest in the bottom line is that the greater openness to migration and also the greater sort of foreign aid and cooperation and globalization, the less pressure there is on potentially climate impacted communities and on migration. And that happens in a few ways. It, first of all, it boosts wealth of countries around the world, not just in the United States, when that kind of interaction exists. And wealth is associated with lower population rates, lower reproduction rates, and greater stability. So, you know, in theory, that lessens the migration pressures. And on the other hand, the reflexive response of kind of closing borders or making countries more secure, and we're seeing this wave of nationalism that's immigration driven in the United States and across Europe. The model suggests that that kind of self-protectionist response actually leads to greater poverty in a lot of parts of the world, to greater population growth, and to more instability and to more migration pressures. So, you know, building a wall in the southern part of the United States might have some purposes, but we can also expect it to exacerbate the problem or the challenges of displaced people and unsettled populations.
Yes, so you probably know the work of journalist Todd Miller, whom I interviewed, and he's written extensively about borders and the militarization of border walls. He uncovered Pentagon internal documents that speculate about possible scenarios and contingency plans in which the U.S. military might use excessive force to prevent starving millions from entering the country. So it's a scary possibility that I don't really like thinking about.
I'm not sure exactly which you're referring to, only to say that, you know, I think that that's a really extremist kind of fringe contingent, and I hope it stays that way.
So, of course, migration, as you say, is not only a whole of government issue, but also a whole of society issue. And I find it astonishing that the projections from the UN International Organization for Migration, it estimates that up to 1.4 billion people will be potentially migrating by 2060. But there isn't a single global body or organization specifically and exclusively overseeing climate-related migration. But I understand that your research helped prompt President Biden's formation of a climate migration study group. So what are your thoughts on how we can better coordinate our efforts on a local, national, and international level?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I was happy to see the Biden administration take that step, but not much has happened since. And I think that's a sign of failure and also just the desperate need for more coordination, not just from the United States, but globally on this issue. And again, like every European country is really faced with the same challenges. And you see that in, you know, discussions between, I think it was Rishi Sunak and the Austrian, you know, premier this week. And the United Nations has, you know, an informal body to address climate-driven migration. And the majority of countries around the world have signed a memorandum of understanding, essentially, you know, that pledges their intent to do something about this. But there's really no mechanism for how to do it. And when, just like other climate related negotiations get increasingly, you know, protracted and bogged down, I think the conversation about global migration does as well for a number of reasons. It very quickly gets to questions about responsibility and loss and damage. And the United States is proportionately largely responsible for the changes in our global environment for warming. So the question is, you know, should the United States and other Western nations that have emitted large amounts of carbon also be responsible disproportionately for facilitating that migration that the United Nations projects? Or do we just, you know, resist that and push it off and defend against it? And countries at the negotiation table don't want that direct responsibility. They don't want it to be defined in concrete terms because it becomes a liability and nobody's sure how to proceed. And there's also a great amount of sensitivity about, you know, whether climate driven migrants should be considered refugees, which is a legal status defined by the United Nations, basically referring to persecuted people who are fleeing violence. And that also, the, you know, refugee status triggers, you know, certain specific responsibilities to accept and handle migrants. And so from the United States, from a policy perspective, all that we see mostly, despite the Biden administration's best intentions, is really resistance to dealing with this challenge head on. And my belief from conversations that I've had with people in or close to the administration is that they understand this era of mass movement of people, much the same way that I do. And they've articulated their versions of its significance to me and the need for action, the need for foreign aid, the challenges at borders, the need for empathy and to support, you know, people around the world. But that hasn't translated into any kind of concrete policy. And I think that it might be avoidable for a short time longer, but I think, like with anything, if we can plan in advance, we'll be a lot better off when the rate of population movement picks up, which I believe it will. And if we wait and don't take action, we'll eventually be forced into action and it'll be a more reactive and defensive posture.
Yes. On that note, I recently interviewed Colonel Robin Phillips, who worked at the Pentagon in the Intelligence Directorate, and her responsibilities involved monitoring 48 countries on a daily basis, focusing on land and maritime. And in our conversation, she highlighted the growing recognition across all sectors of the need for substantial reform in the 21st century. Like you, she pointed out that addressing these issues is complex and challenging and stems from logistical and cultural barriers that may be hard to overcome. She stressed that competition for dwindling resources can lead to friction and ultimately conflict. But I guess in the meantime, while we work out those things on a national and global scale, we as individuals just have to make our own plans. We haven't really talked about the private sector so much, but what are some of those common sense solutions that you're seeing in terms of making cities future ready for those cities, those haven cities who might be welcoming migrants from the south, you know, ways of building communities and connection? Or you also write about in your chapter 3, the Great American Climate Scam, about these subsidies to insurance and they're giving us false readings in the market. Just to go into that, maybe there are other ways that we could subsidize being future ready rather than making these unsafe areas of the country seem viable when in fact they aren't.
Yeah, let me start with the first part. I mean, I think the goal is to make Americans as strong in the face of these challenges as possible. And when I ask dozens of experts about how to do that, the answer is, you know, to strengthen the stability of their home, the stability of their income, and the stability of their communities in almost the exact same ways that we've known we need to do for many decades already. So it doesn't require a lot of change in terms of adapting to climate migration and making communities more resilient. And, you know, it kind of points to some very idealized policy goals, but things like improving the availability of childcare and the affordability of childcare, because that's an affordability issue for a lot of American families that affects how much savings they have. And those savings translate to how much flexibility does a family have to evacuate from a disaster or to move in response to a slow moving change or to rebuild a home that's damaged. So that financial stability that depends on social policy directly translates to how flexible and how resilient, you know, an individual or a family is to adapt to climate-driven change. And so that becomes one of the most important. How do you support communities in the same way so we've always needed to? They need, you know, safe, efficient, affordable places to live and practical and efficient ways to get to work and jobs to work at and schools to be educated at. And those are the things that for a city or an American town that is going to face very fast moving growth, those are the things that will keep that community from kind of splitting at the seams. Because again, it's sort of advanced planning versus reactive planning. If you are prepared for that growth, then you receive it gracefully. And if you're not prepared for it, it's overwhelming. And it creates social friction and financial friction and can be an extraordinarily stressful experience for a community. And we've seen models of that in the United States. I write, for example, about Chico, California, which is just down the road from the town of Paradise, California, which had a disastrous wildfire in 2018, and the entire town burned down and 35,000 or so residents fled. And so many of them drove down the road to the city of Chico, which is a city of about 100,000 people. And Chico welcomed them with open arms and really had the best of intentions. They're neighbors, they're Americans, they're not from far away. But within a couple of weeks, that began to shift because Chico really didn't have the resources or the infrastructure to accept such a large, fast influx of people. And There was no parking. Crime rates went up. Their sewer infrastructure system was overwhelmed. And, you know, a tax increase was floated in the community to pay for rehabilitating that sewage infrastructure system. And so very quickly, the welcome wore out and people wanted, you know, the migrants in that case, their neighbors to leave. They couldn't handle it anymore. And that's kind of a model for the risk scenario. And that model applies whether it's Central Americans coming over the border into Texas and Arizona, or whether it's Californians moving to Idaho. It is, you know, a community on community pressure that's really only mitigated by advanced planning and a kind of pacing of change. The second part is this question of why do Americans live in so many dangerous places? And even as I write this book, 8 out of 10 of the fastest growing regions in the country are the places that I identify as being the most at risk and probably the places that we'll see people migrate away from in large numbers. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But among them are ways that the United States has systematically incentivized people to move to dangerous places. And we've done that by subsidizing the costs of the risks of many of these places. So I focus in the book quite a bit on the role of property insurance, on housing insurance, and the way that a lot of states across the country are guaranteeing the availability of inexpensive insurance to repair people's homes, even when they live in the path of destruction or face enormous climate risk. And this is a practice that arose out of the state of Florida after Hurricane Andrew in 1992. Tens of thousands of structures were destroyed. The commercial insurance companies left the state of Florida. They canceled policies and said they wouldn't offer them anymore. And the state of Florida looked at their communities and saw the potential to lose population, saw the potential for an outflow of people and the collapse of its economy, and basically said, we can't have that happen. We're going to create a solution. And that solution is going to be to create a state-run insurance company. We'll promise that we can provide insurance to everybody who chooses to still live on the coast or in the path of future hurricanes. And we promised that we'll basically discount commercial prices by 20%. And it was hugely successful. Millions more people have moved to Florida. It's remained and always has been one of the fastest growing, if not the fastest growing state in the country. And a lot of the reason for that is because insurance was cheap when the risk was extremely high. And the insurance professionals that I talk about how that's mismatched. They think of the world in terms of risk and the cost of that risk. And risk is a signal that tells us, you know, how vulnerable we are, how vulnerable our assets are, our savings, our retirement accounts, things like that. And the cost of insurance is supposed to reflect that. And maybe we assume that cost, but it is at least a communication tool to let us know how much danger we're in. And so when the state of Florida, you know, subsidizes that insurance and then discounts the cost of it, it's blinding its residents to the real hurricane risk that they face, to the real climate risk that they face. And this has been replicated across 30 states because Florida was so successful. It is a primary tool that California is using now to offer insurance to people at risk of wildfire in places where insurance companies are pulling back. It's a complex problem. I don't mean to oversimplify it, but one of the effects is that it makes it difficult for people to see the real climate risk that they face and the real economic danger that they're in because of that climate risk. And as a result, people have across the country moved into wildfire zones, moved into coastal zones, moved into places with limited amounts of water, and also been less politically active in response to that because they haven't experienced that personal threat. They haven't had skin in the game in the climate conversation. And it's helped keep the climate conversation a little bit more ethereal and philosophical instead of it being a household, you know, pocketbooks issue across the political spectrum.
You know, how would that incentive system work, incentivizing people to move from one state to another? What kind of exchange would motivate them to do that? How would wealthier states with high-risk areas encourage people to move to less populated areas that may not have as much infrastructure? I mean, what could be done to make this appealing, considering it seems to go against their own interests?
I'm not sure that the future model is going to be either practically or should be, you know, states trying to facilitate people moving out or moving to other states. That's a challenge, maybe an insurmountable challenge. The other challenge that is enormous, but we will have to sort out, is how do we change the entire incentive structure around growth to adapt to this situation? And that might not be an interstate issue, but it is a, you know, it's an issue that every single community faces in different ways. Our entire identity in the United States is built around economic growth. Our definition of prosperity has to do with economic growth, and our political representation is dependent on economic growth or on growth in general, right? So our congressional districts and our representation in Washington is defined by how many people live in a certain area. And if that population decreases, as it has in parts of California, you lose representation in Congress. And, you know, on a city level, you lose a tax base. And so city managers or city government have less money to work with. And so they feel like they have, and they do have less opportunity to build things or invest in things or pay their own salaries. And so all of these arrows point in one direction, and it's the wrong direction in terms of the context of climate change and, you know, potential migration from it. And so I don't have easy answers for how you fix that. It's a systemic problem and a huge challenge that is going to require a lot of smart minds. And some of the people that I talk about, you know, breaking down silos between agencies of expertise, you know, better communication between the health department and the building departments or the transportation departments in individual communities. Others point to the need to break down divisions between levels of government. You know, we have federal, state, county, local systems, and they don't always coordinate, and they can't always coordinate. I did a lot of reporting in the city of Atlanta, for example, and without going into too much detail, one of the challenges that Atlanta faces is that, you know, its metropolitan areas surrounded by suburban areas that are different cities with different political values. And so as people have moved across that city line, Atlanta literally loses any leverage or influence that it has over policy in the communities where those people move to. And then it's up to an entirely different community and an entirely different government system to figure out how to support those people. So we have all these sort of barriers, and it would be nice if there was a more regionally and federally coordinated effort to address demographic change, or at least to guide it, create best practices, create funding mechanisms, and some guidance for projects that are needed. But we haven't seen that yet.
My name is Sophia Reeser, and I study English and creative writing at Barnard College. I'm inclined to think about big picture topics in terms of the impact of a powerful narrative. And in exploring Lustgarten's body of work, the one thing that stands out to me most about his journalism is his ability to put something as inherently visual and vast as nature into words. He somehow always manages to simultaneously capture the extent of nature's beauty and awe, but also the magnitude of its devastation and the urgency of its protection. Lustgarten's connection to his subject matter is clear. This is someone who deeply cares about nature, and his writing is infused with that passion. But I've also noticed another way through which he manages to communicate the weight and the importance of his topics. And this is by always reminding us of the humanity which lies at the heart of every issue he reports on. No matter how big the scope of a project is, whether he's investigating the history of a massive international company like BP, or reporting on a river that supplies water to people across seven states and Mexico like the Colorado, or researching an issue as far-reaching as climate migration, Lustgarten always puts faces to his facts and statistics. In the Spill documentary, that meant telling the stories of the workers and families affected by BP's recklessness. In Killing the Colorado, it meant holding officials accountable for their irresponsible management of water distribution rights. Now, with On the Move, it looks like highlighting the voices of people like Colette Pichon-Battle and her struggle to navigate the impossible choice of whether to stand her ground and rebuild her sinking home and community, or leave it all behind. Journalism, especially now, is an uncertain profession, and with each new project, there is so much that is unknown. You can never guarantee that people will listen to what you have to say. You can't guarantee that the officials or corporations you hold accountable will change. And if you're a journalist fighting for the future of our dying planet, as Lustgarten does, that list of uncertainties only grows. The only thing that is really in your control is how you choose to tell the stories you share. Framing is everything. You can't know whether people will listen, but you can choose how you shape a narrative and how you piece together your research into the story you present to the world. Of course, there are still questions to contend with. There always will be. And one of the biggest is, how do you dedicate your life working for an uncertain field, fighting for a cause whose outcome you can never guarantee? Well, maybe it's not so different from the situation in Slidell, Louisiana, which Lustgarten talks about in On the Move. There, despite destruction by natural disasters and sea levels which rise higher and higher as time passes, the community continues to grow. Some people leave, of course, but others stay. And despite what the future may hold, new people come. They buy land and, as Lustgarten writes, they continue to build anyway. In a time of uncertain futures and unanswerable questions, sometimes that's all we can do. And this is what Lustgarten does with his work. He continues to build anyway. Now, back to the interview. For me, when we talk about climate migration within the U.S. on a large scale, it sort of calls to mind the older idea of manifest destiny, where in the 19th century, many Americans believed, you know, they were divinely ordained to settle or conquer the West. Whereas today, there are now Americans in that same region who are facing the decision of whether to leave their homes and move elsewhere. So I was wondering if you found at all that climate migration, particularly out of the Western U.S., the Southwest, dialogues with the idea of like the American dream or spirit or even manifest destiny in the way that it's affecting these American communities?
That's a great and complex question. I think there's a couple of levels in which that resonates with me, but none of them directly. It's just difficult. But one of the ways that I've personally begun to think about climate migration as I reflect on how it's affected me is the loss of a certain kind of freedom. This only partially addresses your question, but the loss of a certain kind of freedom to choose where I want to live whimsically or based on subjective values like how beautiful it is or how inviting it seems, things like that. And that freedom will be replaced with a more pragmatic necessity to live in a place because it is safe or because it is viable or you can grow food. So that in terms of, you know, manifest destiny attitude, it reflects a loss of a certain kind of privilege and flexibility. And that's from one perspective of what, you know, manifest destiny is about. The other is about maybe the darker side of that manifest destiny, right? The displacement of so many people, of Native people in the United States, and of just this sort of cultural assumption that white Americans primarily get to choose wherever they want to be and go there and take that place for themselves. So for me, there's no clear trends here, except that a lot of my reporting on this issue has focused on how incredibly inequitable the impacts of climate change are. And in terms of climate migration, those inequities are really exacerbating and amplifying all of our inequities from the past, too, in really potentially disastrous ways. The most vulnerable communities in the United States to climate change and to climate migration are the same communities that have been made more vulnerable over the last 100 years by lots and lots of policies, from redlining and undervaluing minority communities' real estate values to, you know, to slavery. We know pretty clearly that all of the changes we're talking about in this conversation, that the pressures will fall unequally and that the opportunities to adapt to them are going to be greater for privileged communities, people who have more money, but also people who have been, you know, less held down. And semi-cynically, I don't think that we will solve that perfectly. I think that the change is going to come fast and be large, and we're going to be sort of desperately adapting in the best ways we can, and we won't fix all of those structural problems. But I also think that it's an opportunity in a sense. You know, we're already deep in a conversation about how significant our historical inequities have been, important it is to change them. And disruption, you know, climate disruption is an opportunity to enact more change. And if we can have that conversation like we're having right now and more so, then that's an opportunity to fix some of it. You know, your question is about, I took your question as a, you know, big regional level, like how do you fairly steer populations across the country? And I don't know. But when you get down to community level, and you start thinking about very specific adaptations that Mia was asking about, that in a very real way has lots of opportunities to address structural inequities, and they need to be addressed because those are the things that stabilize communities and make them stronger in the face of change. And so I write in the book a bit about Los Angeles's efforts to plant, you know, 90,000 trees. And that's a classic example where in Los Angeles, historical inequities and redlining in particular have led to a lack of green space, you know, in minority and impoverished communities across the city. And so there are no trees, there are no parks in the poorest and Latino and Black parts of Los Angeles. And those communities now, with climate change and heat waves, are hotter than the communities that have trees and parks by 5 to 10 degrees. And that 5 to 10 degrees is oppressive and is literally killing people. There's higher mortality rates, higher rates of cardiac arrest and other associated diseases with extreme heat in those communities. So that's a really clear example of how climate change is disproportionately affecting underprivileged communities, and a really clear example of the opportunity to change that in concrete ways. And as Los Angeles goes and plants 90,000 trees, they're doing it first, as they should, in the communities that have none more than the communities that have some. And that's a, you know, a very small step to leveling just one little part of the playing field, but all those small steps can start to add up. Atlanta's become a case study in how a lot of climate forward thinking and planning that is really good work can also lead to the gentrification of minority neighborhoods and displace more people, unfortunately. And so that's been a hard lesson to learn, and it's been an imperfect process, but it's alerted people across the country to the gentrification that comes with climate migration. And so Atlanta, I think, is a little late to the game, but has begun to address this in ways like stabilizing property tax rates so that as a community gentrifies, people who have lived there in multi-generational homes and, you know, wish to remain there, don't see their property values increase and don't see their tax rates increase, which is the thing that usually pushes foreign minority communities to have to move out of a gentrifying area. So they're financially protecting them against that gentrification. And that's the kind of thing, like, I think across the country, as we talk about climate migration and equity, tax policies in particular to shield people from gentrification is critically important.
I also wanted to ask about your older project, Killing the Colorado. I know you were talking about the Colorado River a little bit earlier, and I've been wondering how, as a writer, you grapple with putting this inherently visual, huge, multifaceted feature of nature, like the river, which is almost 1,500 miles long, and also the importance of protecting it, into words.
Thank you for that question. I love it, but I don't know. I don't know exactly how. It's what I love to do. So, you know, that's my goal in my work. And I assume that I succeed at it sometimes. But it's not like there's a clear strategy or methodology. It's sort of intuitive in a way. And like with that project, it draws on a couple of things about me. I began my career as a photographer. I'm very visually oriented. And so I'm always interested in all that that means, like the visual appreciation of a place and also sort of the big picture and whole picture. But also, I'm a really outdoorsy, adventurous person too. And I've spent a lot of time in that particular geography. And it's a place that I know really well and I understand really well and is extremely varied in its landscape, from alpine mountains to desert canyons. And I've spent time in all of those environments. And so I think in that, like on that particular project, that also helps me tie together a big complex picture.
Yeah. I was also wondering about just in general, you know, your work as a journalist focuses on the threats to our dying planet. We're also in a time where it could be said that journalism itself is a threatened, maybe even dying industry, some would say. So I was wondering how you see the future of the field and what advice you might have for young aspiring journalists.
Yeah, it is not the best moment for the life of the journalism industry, and it's never been more important. So it has to survive. We're, you know, collectively critically threatened by journalism trying to proceed as a profitable business venture and the expectation that corporations can run media outlets and that their success should be defined by how much revenue they make, I just think is out of whack with the societal service that journalism provides. And so on one hand, we need to fix that. I worked for a nonprofit that is insulated from that process. And I think it's one of the reasons that ProPublica succeeds, because we don't have to make a great profit. You know, we do have to sustain ourselves, but we don't have to make a lot of money. And so that's one criteria that really needs to change. And the other, and it's harder to solve, is the consolidation of media by the big successful outlets, you know, and the loss of local reporting, which is so critical and really in many ways more important than what the New York Times does on a national or global level, to be able to have small communities know what's happening in their own school districts and their own streets and, you know, hold their own local officials accountable. And that's just disappearing. And it's a really hard challenge to address, because it requires money, but it also requires dedication and training and committed people. And as a career choice, it's a hard sell. Like, we don't make a lot of money and we're not always very appreciated. As you point out, I mean, there's a lot of skepticism and a lot of distrust for the media. So it's sort of a thankless position at the moment. I don't think historically it's always been that way, and I don't think it will be. But at the present moment, it's a tough environment to tell young people to go into. And I recognize that that's difficult, but I think it's really important. And I would still encourage anybody who's interested to do it. And, you know, what I tell them is do it if it's based on a sense of mission, not an ambition, certainly to make money, because there is none. I went to graduate school. I took on debt to study journalism. I wouldn't recommend that for other people. I think, you know, you learn through practice. And if you combine that need for practical practice with the need for local reporting, I'd say aspiring journalists should just start doing the journalism, whether you publish it on your own website or you go do it in a small town for a small struggling newspaper or a small struggling website. That's where the experience comes from. And then you're immediately injecting content and good reporting into that world that needs it at the same time that you're learning.
And on that note, in terms of the future, of course, I don't know what journalism will look like in the next 10 years. And added into that, we have the revolution of AI and introducing all these elements of distrust from synthetic media or even writing stories, which maybe don't move us, but, you know, extract the different elements that have been reported on by journalists such as yourself. So what are your reflections on the way AI is changing your field? You know, storytelling, even the future of education and work, it seems to be changing everything.
Yeah, my first feeling about AI, but not complete feeling, is of great apprehension. My greatest fear is really about how it affects politics and both distorts the truth and distorts our sense of the truth. And so that's an order of magnitude greater concern for me than the preservation of my job of automation, right? So, but I think we're at a really dangerous moment where AI has the potential to propel all of these trends that we're already seeing without AI of misinformation, of manufactured information that blurs the lines between what's real and what's not. And the danger in that is that not only do we not know what's real and what's true, but that the journalist community that is responsible for holding the world accountable and providing a lot of information, it loses value and its product becomes really murky if you can't distinguish it. So I'm really concerned about the dilution of truth, first and foremost. I have some concerns, but I think that they're kind of manageable about the automation of my job, about, you know, disseminating information. I think that there's opportunities in AI and it can provide efficiencies and it could probably help us in a lot of ways, whether it's sort of medical advancements or even automating writing stories or disseminating information that needs to happen in a cost-effective and efficient way. But I don't think that AI can replace the guts and brains behind actual reporting. I mean, the AI can't go out and gather new information. It can reflect back to us information that's already kind of known. And so in terms of journalism, I think that that means some degree of content creation is going to be automated, but probably not the most important parts of it and not the new reporting and not the deep reporting. And so, you know, I have some confidence that there's always going to be a role for providing that so long as the integrity of truth is preserved. So back to my sort of first order concern, and that's where I think the biggest risk is.
Yes, I'm very much for guardrails and governance for AI. And then on the other hand, perhaps you've come across in your reporting, there are these AI solutions that might help us balance the power grid. You talk about efficiencies or coordination between cities and migration, and to understand you don't want all people moving to the same cities because then you create another problem, as you say, with the housing crisis. So as you reflect on possible AI solutions to create a sustainable cities and manage the climate migration.
That's an interesting question. I don't know. I've never heard anybody talk about creating a big picture approach to mass demographic change, you know, through sort of the wisdom of AI. But I think that in the granular, real micro level, right, there's a whole lot of opportunities for economic analysis of communities and people's behavior and household data that we don't do because it's too laborious or that we don't know how to do as humans that AI, you know, might be able to enlighten us about. Things that give us sharper pictures of the way communities use energy, for example, in a grid sense, like how does a neighborhood use energy? What times a day does it use it? And what are opportunities to make that more efficient, which would translate to more affordable and which directly translates to climate pressures and migration? Because a lot of the way I think of climate-driven migration ties back to what are the economic impacts to people. And one of those impacts are the costs of cooling, of air conditioning, for example. So we're like way down the rabbit hole in that, but that's an example of really technical and specific ways that I think AI has the potential to aid in the technological solutions to climate challenges in general and to migration specifically.
And you spoke about your connection with nature, and could you share some of your reflections on the beauty and wonder of the natural world? You know, why you're staying in Northern California for the moment? This has been a part of your life and why you choose to report on it.
To me, this is, you know, it's very personal, but to me, our natural environment is everything. it's where I recreate, but it's more than just for sort of fun and entertainment. It's, you know, it's church. It's the most valuable and beautiful thing that we have, our natural surroundings. And for me, it's where, you know, I find peace and clarity and where I'm able to unload some of my own stresses or anxieties. It's where I, you know, creative inspiration and rejuvenation. For me, all of these things are always made possible in one kind of beautiful, natural, untouched environment or another. And so I'm not like mission driven. I didn't get into my career to protect the environment so explicitly, but it's always been from the very start a core fundamental value and second maybe to my family, you know, the most important thing to me. It fuels me and it influences how I see every story I do and most things that I think about.
So I think about the future and education, perhaps as teachers or mentors or collaborators that have been important to you and what you tell your own children. What would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
Yeah. I mean, in the context of climate change, I mean, this is a really tough one. There's so many directions to go with this question. The two would choose, first of all, what we do still really, really matters in terms of defining what the future looks like. Like, I don't think that climate change in an apocalyptic sense is a foregone conclusion. And our efforts to change that trajectory to lower emissions will change how severe the impacts are in the future. So I really want people to understand that. And I really want my kids to understand that. And I also want people to understand that we might be entering an era of unprecedented change and disruption, and that's going to be very challenging, but that it's all relative. And this is, I think about my kids in particular, you know, this is the life that we've got. And I feel great sadness for the things that I know that we've lost, but younger people don't have that perspective, which in this particular context is maybe a relief. And so all there is what's in front of them. And there is an ample supply of natural beauty that we were just talking about, of like rejuvenating and inspiring resources in our natural environment and in the people around us. And I would just say, as we all settle into a less predictable future with all sorts of bumpy roads and roller coaster rides, that we also stay focused on experiencing what's in the moment in, you know, that beauty and that community.
It's so important. Yes, we can rewrite our future. It doesn't all have to be disruption and change. It can also mean beauty and regeneration. So thank you, Abram Lustgarten, for telling these important human stories behind climate migration and our need to foster a deeper understanding and collective response to one of the most pressing issues of our time. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you so much for your interest and for having me in this conversation.
One Planet Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Sophia Reeser with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producer and associate text editor on this episode was Sophia Reeser. One Planet Podcast is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Theme music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you've enjoyed this program. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast and be part of the climate change solution, just drop us a line at team@oneplanetpodcast.org. Thank you for listening.